This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. November 4th, 1979, 25 years ago today, hundreds of Iranian students stormed the walls of the U.S. Embassy in Tehran. They seized the compound, took the entire U.S. diplomatic mission hostage, and triggered a crisis that absorbed the attention of the country and profoundly affected politics in both the U.S. and Iran. Though it continues to be the single most important moment in American relations with post-revolutionary Iran, for many, the hostage crisis has been overshadowed by more recent and more violent episodes. In retrospect, the hostage crisis can be seen as the first confrontation between the United States and radical Islam. With the advantages of hindsight, it illustrates some important lessons about how the U.S. government, the media, and the American people respond in crisis. Throughout this program, by the way, NPR News will continue to monitor developments in Paris, where Yasser Arafat, the head of the Palestinian Authority, is in grave condition. Later in the program, we also hope to speak with John Micklethwaite of The Economist and get some European reaction to the re-election of President George W. Bush here in the United States earlier this week. But first, 25 years later, what can we learn from the hostage crisis in Iran? Do you remember the crisis, the yellow ribbons, the countdown of the days? What lessons do you think we should draw? Our number here in Washington is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. The email address, totn@npr.org. Joining us now is David Farber. He's a history professor at Temple University, the author of Taken Hostage, The Iran Hostage Crisis and America's First Encounter with Radical Islam. He's with us from the studios of member station WHYY in Philadelphia. Thanks very much for being with us today.
Thanks for inviting me.
As you point out in the book, we date the crisis 25 years ago today. Others use different dates.
Yeah, one of the things that's worth remembering is that for the Iranian people, the crisis sure didn't begin November 1979. They've got a different history, and part of our problem as Americans was to recognize how differently they saw those events. They saw a history that stretched back at least to 1953, when the United States first got itself deeply involved in Iranian politics.
And, overthrew the prime minister of Iran, Mr. Mossadegh, and reinstalled the Shah.
Yeah, we tended not to know too much about that here in the United States. It was seen as some sort of internal Iranian affair. Alas, the Iranians were well aware that our own CIA was deeply enmeshed in the plot that successfully overthrew the duly elected prime minister of Iran and put our fella, the Shah, in place.
Now, take us back to the situation as it was in Iran before the hostage crisis began. One of the big misconceptions I think most Americans had was that this incident had to have been a product of the Iranian government.
Yeah, that's a terrific point and really speaks to some of the problems we still have today in the war on terrorism. What happened in Iran was not some sort of government-to-government formal policy declaration with clear rational directives and goals. What you had in Iran in 1978 and then into 1979 was a revolutionary atmosphere. There was no one clearly in control of that country, even through November 1979. And in fact, the hostage-taking was very much more about internal Iranian politics than it was directly about some attempt to sway the United States in its global directions. And we, alas, really didn't know that then, and we still today have a lot of trouble understanding how these non-government activists, these radicals, these terrorists, are trying to move politics in a direction that doesn't respond formally to government relationships.
Ayatollah Khomeini, the imam, as he was known in Iran, a very important word, a very important man, but he was not running the government then. There was a prime minister, Mehdi Bazargan.
Yeah, well done. Well pronounced, too. I'm quite impressed.
Thank you.
Better than me. I'll let you keep saying the names. What was happening at that time was there were factions wrestling for control of central authority in Iran. There was a revolution going on. Khomeini spoke for the Revolutionary Council. He was attempting to create an Islamic theocracy. It wasn't clear what direction that government was going to go at that time. The hostage takers were very much hoping that Khomeini would exert more authority, would take over in some ways formal responsibility. They were working not with him, but in hopes that their acts would help him. And that's what we saw happening November 1979.
And indeed, it did indirectly help him, but it also locked him into support for their position because it proved to be, I think, partly to the surprise of the hostage takers themselves, wildly popular.
Yeah, you said it. I mean, as unpopular as it was in the United States, as horrific as Americans responded to it, so many people in Iran found this just delightful. Here were these Iranian students who were able to basically tweak the tiger's tail. They showed America who was boss. Somehow the great Satan was being humbled by just a few hundred Iranian students backed up by thousands of others.
Mm-hmm. And the thousands of others are what, in fact, made this situation intractable.
Yeah, it got so hard so fast because what you had was a few hundred students, maybe only about 150, who thought they were going to do some sort of symbolic sit-in, as they called it quaintly enough at the time. They only planned to be there a couple, 3 days probably. But as you said, quickly enough, this became so popular in Iran, the Khomeini came out in support of their sit-in, and suddenly it was a bold act, and no one on either side really knew how to get out of it.
One of the main points of your book is you're surprised in retrospect by the degree to which the U.S. government, of course, the president at the time was Jimmy Carter, Cyrus Vance was the Secretary of State, Zbigniew Brzezinski was the National Security Advisor, the degree to which the United States saw this all through the prism of the Cold War, and indeed the Soviet Union saw it the same way.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I'm a historian by trade. I wasn't really surprised so much as, well, upset that Americans in government couldn't somehow break out of that paradigm. I mean, sure, there it was, Iran bordering on the Soviet Union, Persian oil, Gulf oil everywhere to be had. It makes sense that Americans worried about Soviet influence in the region. But so quickly it became apparent that the Islamic fundamentalists were after a very different game than playing in the bipolar world that both the Soviets and the United States thought they'd created. And what was so difficult for American policymakers, with maybe the partial exception of Brzezinski, who was a pretty clever guy, they couldn't figure out how to rethink the dynamic at work.
Brzezinski, you write, a fascinating memo that he writes, and you put it in your book. Quote, this is Zbigniew Brzezinski. We will clearly have to continue to pursue our relations with individual Muslim countries on the basis of shared interests, but our emphasis on moral as well as material values, our support for a world of diversity, and our commitment to social justice should place us in a strong position to deepen our dialogue with the Muslim world.
Yeah, isn't that great? What an interesting opening, what an interesting rethinking going on at that point. And that's one of the fun things this book was able to do was a whole slew of documents have just become declassified, so we're for the first time seeing the internal workings of the Carter White House. So there's Brzezinski saying, something new is afoot in the world. How do we take advantage of this? How do we show some kind of solidarity with the Islamic world as it's rethinking its place in global civilization? But quickly enough, that got put to the side, way on the back burner. Soviet affairs, don't forget that Afghanistan gets invaded by the Soviet Union just weeks after the hostage crisis starts, and suddenly the old Cold War paradigm really just takes grip again over so many of the policy possibilities.
And indeed, the following year, the Iran-Iraq War erupts.
Yeah, absolutely. And in some ways, that put things back into the position of government-to-government relationships. Here were nation-states doing what they do, fighting each other, and what so many in Iran hoped, which was to create a huge Islamic theocracy throughout the region, that too got pushed backward. Their agenda also wasn't able to move forward the way they'd hoped. They got involved in the geopolitics of their region.
Let's get some listeners involved in the conversation. If you'd like to join us, it's 800-989-8255. The email address is totn@npr.org. We're speaking with David Farber. His book is Taken Hostage. And joining us is Robert, who's on the line from Wichita, Kansas.
Hello.
Hello.
I enjoy your show.
Thank you.
My question is regarding Jimmy Carter's responsibility in the present war on terrorism, dating back to that time period.
Okay, David Farber.
Sure. Yeah, that's an interesting question. I mean, I think one of the problems Carter had and one of the problems every president has is so often they're responding directly to political problems they face at home. Remember, Carter's in the middle of a re-election campaign in which things are not going swimmingly. And I think Carter had a hard time breaking free of his own internal politics. So rather than set up a kind of deeply thought-out, rational response to changing global affairs, he had to respond hard and fast to a very popular issue in America. Gosh darn it, those terrorists have no right to hurt our people. And policy was very short-term in its orientation, rather than what we'd hope, looking back now over a 25-year narrative trajectory, a long-term strategy. So tactics prevailed, and Carter really wasn't able to do much to change the dynamic that was occurring in that part of the world.
One of the principal lessons, Robert, by the way, thank you for the phone call. One of the principal lessons that many people draw from the crisis, a more practical, tactical lesson, the President of the United States allowed himself to be taken hostage in effect. He didn't leave the White House during the hostage crisis and took over direct control of it, and his obsession left him responsibility for this situation.
Yeah, you know, sometimes history rhymes. We've seen another president involve himself very deeply in these kind of affairs, our current president. For Carter, he'd hoped pretty much for the same results that our President Bush has just had. Carter thought he could resolve the crisis. He thought he could be a hero. He could be the white knight. He could be the guy on the horse who came in and solved the problem. So you see these great memos between Hamilton Jordan, chief of staff of Carter, and the president himself saying, yeah, this is a good issue. We can show leadership with this issue. We can show we're the president. And I think maybe, you know, this is one of those great maybes. If Carter had resolved the crisis, especially maybe 2 weeks before the election, well, who knows? But he didn't, and his presidency was tied to the Iran hostage crisis, and it crippled his presidency.
Another president obsessed with hostages, of course, was Ronald Reagan with the hostages in Lebanon and, Iran-Contra. But the point being taken was one of the reasons they became obsessed with all of these situations was their passionate concern for these people and their family and the insult to the United States. This is, after all, a diplomatic mission of the United States, violation of every law.
Yeah, you know, one of the hardest things in the world, we're still facing this today, is that propaganda of the deed, that's what terrorism is effective. I mean, the United States saw 66 of its people taken hostage. Now, in some senses, we're a huge nation of 240 million at that point. Maybe we need to be calm about it. But it's so hard. It's so effective when you see our people blindfolded, handcuffed, mistreated, being humiliated. It's very difficult for a president. It's very difficult for the American people to kind of get ahead of the terrorist goals, which is to hold us hostage. It works too well too often.
Let's get another caller in. Asterion, I hope I'm pronouncing that correctly, is with us from Phoenix.
Hi, yeah, you are.
Okay, go ahead.
Thanks for taking my call. I love your show.
Thank you.
I'm a Persian Gulf War vet from 1991, and I was 9 years old when they took those hostages in 79. And, of course, I didn't understand it, and I've tried to understand it. I've tried to understand the Middle East since I've been back and this whole terrorist thing. I just read a book called All the Shah's Men. I just finished it, and when I heard you having a show, I had to call.
Mm-hmm.
I wish, and it was about the coup in 53, and it gave me more understanding. I wish the United States would recognize people in the United States. I wish we would recognize more the policies we have that have affected people's attitudes in the Middle East. We claim to be a democracy, and we have a brand of it, but we've stopped other nations from their own democratic process. I mean, the revolution came in 79, and people were totally horrified that the CIA was going to come in again and do what they did in 53. The country of Iran loved us. Mossadegh loved us. They looked at us as a ideal democracy that they wanted to emulate, and we threw it all away for imperialism, for oil, for this role that we took over from Europe and being an imperialist country. That's a sad thing to realize.
Very quick.
I try to understand the events that have happened in this country.
David Farber, quickly, we're just running out of time in the segment. Was it oil or, again, was it Cold War?
1953, it was both, but sure, oil had a big role in it. It still does. It always will. And that's a reality we have to deal with. It makes our policies tighter and harder to wrestle with sometimes.
And very quickly, also, the hostility engendered by the hostage crisis was a principal reason why the United States supported Saddam Hussein and Iraq in the Iran-Iraq War.
Irony upon irony. That's just the way geopolitics tends to work.
Asterion, thanks very much for the call. We appreciate it.
Thanks for taking it.
We're talking about the 25th anniversary of the Iranian hostage crisis. When we come back from the break, Mark Bowden joins the conversation. He recently met with many of the leading hostage takers in Tehran. We'll hear what they had to say and what they think about this incident 25 years on. If you'd like to join the conversation, 800-989-8255, TOTN at NPR.org. I'm Neil Conan. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. It's the 25th anniversary of the beginning of the Iranian hostage crisis, which played out for another 443 days. With us is history professor David Farber, the author of Taken Hostage, The Iran Hostage Crisis and America's First Encounter with Radical Islam. If you remember what happened then, what lessons should we draw from it? Our phone number is 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK, and our email address is totn@npr.org. Also joining us now is Mark Bowden, the author, best known as the author of Black Hawk Down, a national correspondent for the Atlantic Monthly. He's working on a book about the Iranian hostage crisis and tracked down some of the former leaders of the hostage takers and spoke with them about their experiences. He described that in those encounters in an article called Among the Hostage Takers in the December issue of the Atlantic Monthly. He's also with us from member station WHYY in Philadelphia. Mark, good of you to be with us.
Thanks.
25 years ago, the hostage takers were students. What's happened to them now? Where are they?
Well, they're all over the place. For one thing, they're all middle-aged and a little thicker around the middle and, you know, losing hair or graying hair and wearing bifocals these days. Some are active in the government of Iran. Some of them are leaders of the reform movement. Some have fled Iran and are actually part of the MKO, the violent resistance movement opposed to the regime.
Do they, well, obviously they probably have different reactions. Do some regret it? Do some still praise it?
Yeah, they do have different reactions. And those who regret it tend to be those who are involved in trying to reform the theocracy in Iran. For them, the revolution that started in the late 1970s has ended up turning into a sort of religious totalitarian society, which is not at all what they envisioned. And they still have hopes of, through regular political channels, through journalism, through the arts, influencing policy and trying to reform the country to make it more authentically democratic. Others who are important figures in the regime obviously feel differently and see the takeover of the American embassy as one of the founding events of their revolution and still defend it as appropriate and believe that it played a key role, what Khomeini called the second revolution, greater or more glorious than the first.
Interestingly, Americans all remember the disaster, the fiasco at Desert One, where a rescue mission was attempted and then aborted when sand prevented one of the helicopters from continuing on to the continuing the mission. And then as they were pulling out, there was a collision and eight Marines and airmen were killed in that. Iranians, though, you say, see that as a divine intervention.
They do. You know, of course, countries invent a kind of mythology. They reinvent their own history. And, you know, to Iranians, looking back on it, this takeover of the embassy is viewed as a noble band of unarmed, well-motivated revolutionary students who took on the greatest power in the world, held it at bay for more than a year. And when the great evil, great Satan's powerful commandos came after them to kill them, Allah stirred dust storms in the desert and made their helicopters crash while the Gorogan Girha, the hostage takers, slept peacefully in the embassy. So they see it as an indication that God is on their side.
I'd like both of you to address the situation. Looking at the lessons learned, we sometimes overlook the experiences of those people who were held hostage. David Farber, were well-treated, or reasonably well-treated, if you consider being taken hostage being well-treated. Some were not.
Yeah, it's really important to remember that relative to the nightmare that could have happened, slaughter, these people all survived. They survived with basically their health more or less intact. But they were brutalized in psychological ways and in several cases physically. Some of them thought they were going to be killed. They were threatened with death. They had guns pointed at their heads. This was no fun whatsoever, and it just went on and on. And you can imagine the toll that took on people's psychological condition, if nothing else.
Yeah, Mark, you describe one particular soldier who just cannot take the hectoring.
I'm not familiar with what you're referring to.
There was one particular interrogator, a woman, who finally drove one of the Marines around the bend.
Yes, Masumeh Ebtekar, who was now a vice president of Iran and in charge of the environment. At the time, she was recruited to be the spokesman for the students who seized the embassy because she actually had been raised as a child briefly in Philadelphia and spoke English with an American accent. And she became the face of the hostage takers for most Americans. And her role in the embassy over the 15 months that the hostages were held was to make propaganda films. And so they were familiar with her showing up with the camera crew and trying to coax them into saying things like how well they were being treated and how evil the United States was and how much they supported the revolution. And obviously, playing that role, she really annoyed a lot of the hostages, and a lot of them still really despise her.
Mm. Let's get some more callers in on the conversation. Charlie joins us from St. Louis, Missouri.
Hi. Very interesting show. It's the first time I've ever been able to get through.
Ah, well, congratulations.
Thank you. Yeah, I was also 9 years old at the time the hostages were taken, and I had lived in Iran as a student. My father worked there. And I went to school with one of the kids of one of the hostages in Tehran. And anyway, we were kicked out of Iran before we were slated to leave because of the revolution. And since then, I've been very interested in the revolution, and I read a lot about it. And one thing I read that really struck me was that the embassy staff in Tehran had kept warning the State Department not to admit the Shah into the United States for medical treatment for fear of something like the hostage taking happening. And I just wanted to know what your author has to say about that.
Well, David Farber, interestingly, a not dissimilar situation happened just a little while before the hostage crisis began.
That's right. In February, a few months earlier, there actually had been a prior takeover of the embassy, and everybody who worked at the staff at the embassy knew that things were very fragile. Remember that almost all the embassy staff was gone by time of the November takeover. There was a real sense of how dangerous the situation was. Did they think that the embassy would be taken over again? They thought it was possible. Did they warn that any provocation could be very dangerous to their well-being? Yes, they did. But remember, it was a very fluid situation among the embassy personnel as well. There was no ambassador at that point. He'd been called back and no one else had replaced him. There was, I wouldn't say a leadership vacuum, but there was no certainty of leadership, that's for sure. And yeah, there were warnings, and Carter and the State Department chose to trump those warnings.
Thanks, Charlie.
Thank you.
All right, bye-bye. Let's talk with Kent. Kent's calling from Tucson, Arizona.
Hi, how you doing?
Okay.
Yeah, I guess I wanted to agree with a couple callers ago. I think his name is Asterian or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, just that it makes sense to pay attention to the, you know, the policies that we've had towards the Middle East, you know, and Iran for the past, you know, half a century or so because of the, you know, the consequences and how they sort of bear on what's going on today. So it's always a question of context. Yeah, I mean, so, you know, basically my point is that, you know, without, you know, the history of CIA involvement in Iran and without what happened in 1979, certainly, you know, this served as a justification for, at least, you know, with Reagan, for increasing support for Iraq and the Iran war, and it probably led, you know, somewhat to the removal of Iraq from state sponsors' list of terrorism, I think, you know, in 1982 or something.
Yeah.
And that. And I think, the second thing I wanted to bring up is I sort of challenged the notion that this is the first or, you know, beginnings of our involvement with radical fundamentalist Islam because, you know, in Afghanistan, for example, I think it was Brzezinski sort of, you know, bragged about or claimed that we were already heavily involved with, you know, training, you know, jihadis to, you know, to provoke a Russian invasion. I think it's something he called the Afghan trap.
Mm-hmm. David Farber, is that right? I mean, you described the book. The subtitle is America's First Encounter with Radical Islam.
Yeah, you know, I might be cheating a little bit, but it's more or less that era that begins. I mean, the whole so-called Crescent of Crisis was up for grabs at that point, and really from Yemen to Ethiopia all the way through the Persian Gulf. So really starting in the mid-70s, troubles were on the horizon, and there was an attempt to start figuring out what to do. But to say the least, the Iran hostage crisis put all that into a crystalline form, and suddenly there it was, not to be avoided, and that, I think, was a real takeoff point for a focal issue.
And Mark Bowden, this is a seminal moment in American relations and American experience with radical Islam.
It certainly is. You know, I agree with David. I think that, you know, the United States obviously has had relationships with the Islamic countries and organizations throughout its history. But this was certainly the first time that Americans heard themselves characterized as the great Satan. And this, of course, has become the what we now understand is the way that our country is viewed in many Islamic parts of the world. And it came, at least to me, as a real shock in 1979 that there were large portions of the world who didn't fall into either the Soviet bloc or the Western world, but who nevertheless saw the United States as their enemy and as the source of all evil.
And I know you have to go in a couple of minutes, Mark, and I wanted you to describe before you left, there is a museum that memorializes a lot of these events on the grounds of the American Embassy today.
That's right. The Chancery, which is the main building on the American Embassy grounds in Tehran, is festooned with anti-American graffiti. There's a big sign over the front door that says the Great Aban the 13th Exhibit, which is an exhibit inside. Aban the 13th is the equivalent on the Iranian calendar to November 4th. And inside is a really nasty permanent exhibit to the outrages of the United States. And it looks, I describe it, excuse me, in the story as looking like something that a bunch of high school students made with a bad attitude. Very amateurish, very ugly. I honestly feel like if they gave me a little time, I could probably put together a better anti-American display than that. You know, I think that the way that it comes off to me, and I was there numerous times over the last couple of years, is equivalent to somebody drawing a mustache or a big nose on a poster of someone famous. I mean, it's about that level of criticism. And as such, I think that it really speaks more to the nature of that regime than it does reveal anything of any importance about the United States.
Is it busy? Are a lot of people there?
No, it's not. It's virtually abandoned other than all the guards who are out front. Every year, I just noticed in the paper this morning, they stage a little formal demonstration against the Americans, and it grows smaller and more pro forma each year. They do bring, like, buses of students through to teach them about the glories of the revolution. But my experiences in Iran over the last couple of years have been that the vast majority of Iranians have very little patience for this regime. They don't particularly like living in a society of forced piety and religious behavior. And they also don't view the United States as the great Satan. And they see, I think, and I can't really speak, obviously, for the people of Iran. I can just give you my impression. But the vast majority of people I met are embarrassed by the whole episode and are still embarrassed by the way, you know, this American embassy has become this permanent eyesore in the middle of Tehran.
Mark Bowden, thanks very much for being with us today.
You're welcome.
Mark Bowden, national correspondent for the Atlantic Monthly, best known as the author of Black Hawk Down. His article, Among the Hostage Takers, is in the December issue of the Atlantic, and he was with us from WHYY in Philadelphia. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And let's get another caller on the line. Al joins us from Charlotte, North Carolina. Al?
Yes.
You're on the air.
Yes, sir. I'm an Iranian, and I've been in this country for over 25 years. And I left Iran before the revolution. And my family went through the revolution, Iranians, a lot of Iranians. And there are a lot of things, a lot of facts that are unknown in this country about this revolution that, you know, it makes a big difference to understand what really happened over there. And it's still happening today. Now, there were some things that are going on right now in the world, right now in Iraq, right now in the United States, that have a lot to do with what happened then. Now, can you make some comments about what's going on today in Iraq, its relationship, why the Iranian government is supporting all this terrorism in the world, and all they're doing about it is talking about it in this country? But really, the U.S. government is not really doing anything about it. This administration, in the last 4 years, has done nothing but talk about it.
Let's get a response from David Farber, if you would, Al. Thanks very much.
Sure.
Well, taking the gist of that question, I think one of the things that's really useful for us in the United States to keep in mind is that we sometimes talk about this kind of war of civilizations, like all of them are against all of us. And it's so useful to remember that in Iran right now and in 1979 in the midst of the revolution as well, this was a society like our own that had different factions, different ideals, different hopes, and different aspirations. And Iran today, as Mark was suggesting, is a very different country with a tremendous number of people who were never alive in 1979. And we see a country that is going to go through huge changes. Its relationship with Shiite in Iraq will be part of their policy predicament as well. Mm-hmm. And they're figuring that out just as we're trying to figure out what we're going to do in Iraq.
Let's talk with Bill. Bill's calling from Mesa, Arizona.
Hey, you're bringing back a lot of memories. I was an announcer in the small town of Globe, Arizona at a parade when a hostage came home. And our town had about 8,000 people, but I think there was that many news reporters there when he came to town. But one thing I wanted to point out, when I was announcing the parade, I could never figure out, was there, I was told by the local police that there were people on the roofs, and I saw them. We had government sharpshooters, and for some reason, he was under a lot of protection. There were rumors of threats or something like that, and I wonder if this is the case with a lot of the hostages that came home, if there was concerns about the security. And the other question I want to ask is, what actually led to the release of these hostages? There was rumors that our government paid off the Iranians. What do you guys know?
David Farber?
Let me answer the second question. The question of the October surprise, did William Casey prevent the hostages from being released in October? Did the Reagan administration pay something off? Well, I've looked through the documents, and I'll tell you as a historian, that doesn't always tell you the whole truth. I didn't find any evidence. I didn't find any concern within the Carter administration that the Reagan administration or the prospective Reagan administration was up to no good. So I don't find any paper trail. But Gary Sick wrote an interesting book about this.
Gary Sick was the national security advisor with specializing in Iran.
Staff guy, and he claims he's got some documents. I looked through all of his material that's published. I don't know. I don't see it. I don't think that's how it worked.
Well, you're clear right. Carter taking a lot of personal interest in this because one of the families I talked to, Carter summons the families back to Washington numerous times and talked to them. He seemed to be quite confused from what I got from the families.
Hmm. Well, this is that reality again that you sometimes forget the president's just like a guy. And
right.
Carter, Reagan, I think our current president, you know, these things are emotional. They're very personal. And the more you get to know the families, the more emotional it becomes. And, you know, maybe that's not always so good when you're trying to make rational policy decisions, but it's hard as a human being not to respond to this human tragedy that's going on right in front of you.
And human tragedy of people who work for you.
Yeah. Excellent point.
Let me go back to my first question.
And make it very quick, Bill.
Yeah, there was definitely a security concern in Globe. I happen to have knowledge of it since I was the announcer of this huge parade they had downtown and saw the people on the roofs. But were any other hostages under that extreme security? The people in the town didn't know it. I knew it.
David Farber, very quickly.
Don't know. Never heard of that. Interesting point.
There was a lot of security when they landed at Stewart Air Force Base. I covered that for NPR in their first days back in the country. They were at the Thayer Hotel in West Point, and I was there. Obviously, a lot of security there, but I'm not sure how much there was after that, Bill. But thanks very much for the call. We're going to continue this conversation on the Iranian hostage crisis when we come back from a break and then talk about European reaction to the election. This is NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Today we are talking about the 25th anniversary of, from the American perspective, the start of the Iranian hostage crisis. Our guest is David Farber, a history professor at Temple University, the author of Taken Hostage, The Iran Hostage Crisis and America's First Encounter with Radical Islam. And David, I wanted to ask you before we let you go about the lessons we learned and the lessons we didn't learn.
Yeah, that's it. In some ways, it's so interesting to think back at how history's rhyming today with some of the things that went on 25 years ago. One of the lessons that seems so clear to me is, yeah, this was a crisis. Why was it a crisis? Because we didn't expect it. That's the nature of it. And why didn't we expect it? We had so little understanding of what was going on. We had so little insight into Iranian society, into the changes going on in the Islamic world. One of the things we didn't own in 1979 was a kind of deep knowledge, a deep understanding of those cultures, that particularity of Iran at that moment in time. One of the lessons we still struggle with, we have to know what's going on in other countries. We have to see their perspectives, their histories, their cultures, their politics. And I sadly think that we've yet to learn that lesson. We've done it again and again. We keep not knowing what other societies are doing, how they see us. Second legacy, and it seems just as clear in some ways, is we were, in 1979, beginning a long struggle. a kind of Cold War, if you will. And in 1945, we learned how to do containment against the Soviet Union. You have to fight it on cultural fronts, economic fronts, and last and hopefully least of all, militarily. That's another lesson I think we're still struggling to learn now. How do you contain those aspects of radical Islam that are inimical to our way of life? Because not all of even Islamic fundamentalism is a problem for us. But how do you begin to contain that at a multi-level? And that's something we've just started again to learn.
And similarly to extend the analogy of the Cold War, there were physical constraints to some of that, but the communism was not simply countries, and radical Islam is not simply countries either.
That's right. These are ideologies that are deliberately transnational, and that's what communism was supposed to be. And once we figured out how to make it isolated to a nation state, we did a lot better. I don't think we're going to be able to do that with the kind of threat we face today. So it will be that transnational threat that has to be contained in a very imaginative and creative way. We're struggling to figure those methods out.
David Farber, thanks so much for being with us today.
Thank you.
David Farber's book is Taken Hostage, The Iran Hostage Crisis, America's First Encounter with Radical Islam. And he was with us from the studios of member station WHYY in Philadelphia.